Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 822 by my count. My name is Camden Busey. I'm happy to be back in the studio and delighted to talk with some friends. We're picking up on a conversation that began a few weeks ago. Today, let me introduce to you first our panelist. We have helping me out as a wingman of sorts, Dr. David Van Drunen, who serves as the Robert B. Strimple Professor of Systematic Theology and Christian Ethics at Westminster Seminary, California. Welcome back, Dave. It's good to see you today.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, we're glad you could make it. And we just saw you at Presbytery, but it was nice also that we're able to reconnect and have the opportunity to do that through this tech. We also have with us, so we're spreading the U.S. a little bit. I've got one to my west. We've got one a little bit to my east. We are also very pleased to welcome to the program Dr. Bruce Baugus, who serves as Professor of Systematic Theology and Apologetics, as well as the Director of MA and THM programs at Puritan Reformed Theological Seminary in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Welcome, Bruce. It's good to see you too.
Yeah, thank you for the invitation. Glad to be here.
I'm excited. I don't know if I'll run into you, Bruce, but I'm planning to be in the Grand Rapids area on Friday. I'm coming to, not to toot my own horn here, but I love the great state of Michigan, and I'm planning to be in Wyoming, Michigan at Harvest OPC delivering a lecture on the importance of Van Til today. That was assigned to me. I'm happy to do it, but if someone's wondering, like, if I'm just going around trumpeting my Van Tilianism, I'm not intentionally. I was requested to speak on that subject, but I'll be there Friday night for a pre-presbytery lecture and bringing my family with. So I'm really looking forward to seeing some of the OPC brothers in the area. So sadly, I believe this episode will air after that happens. So if anyone's listening now, I don't know if this has been recorded. If it's going to be online, but if you'd like the material, I can point it to you. So send us a note in the community or at mail@reformedforum.org, and I'll try to make everyone aware of that. Anyway, how are things going at PRTS? It's been a couple of years since I've been on campus, but would you mind giving us a little bit of an update about your goings on?
Yeah, sure. Things are great. I'm loving it here. I've been here just for a year now. Prior to my being here, I was at RTS Jackson for 14 years. But yeah, it's a great place to be. One of the things I really like about being both in the class as well as our other programs here at Puritan Reformed is how many international students we have. So we're about 50%, maybe a little higher than that, actually, here on campus. And then we have partnerships both at the MA and the THM level with Reformed seminaries throughout the world. And so I really enjoy that. I'm actually, just to correct my own biography here, recently rolled off from being director of the MA program.
Oh, there you go.
The THM program, but not the MA program. So that's been handed off, but we have a global team here that I'm still part of.
That's great.
And then the THM program is quite global in its orientation as well. But it's great to be promoting Reformed theology throughout the world.
Amen. Yeah, we appreciate that too. And it's wonderful to see that global influence in OPRTS, as you say, has many students, but certainly Westminster, California has its share of people from other nations as well. And here at Reform Forum, we have all sorts of listeners and viewers and people that are writing in. It's a joy to see a global ecumenical Reform faith and people that are really, really interested, not just in Christianity, which we love, and not even just in general Reformed-ish things, but even people that hold to the Reformed creeds and confessions with great fervor all around the world. So praise be to God for that, and we pray that that would continue. We want to be theological maximalists and seek not just a lowest common denominator form of Christianity around the world, or even a lowest common denominator ecumenism, but I like to be a maximalist and hold out a high hope there. So today we're going to be speaking, picking up a conversation I mentioned from a few weeks ago. We held an online symposium not too long ago on Reformed moral theology. And Dave, I want to thank you again for your great help there. We kind of brainstormed together an online scholarly event, and it came together exceedingly well. We had a great time. Bruce and Dave were both participants in that. We also welcome several others, but two of the other main presenters were Chase Kuhn and T. David Gordon. So that was a wonderful event. We had several hundred people and had registered for that. And we're watching live, some dipping in, some dipping out, because it was a pretty lengthy event. We had four main sessions. So if you include the breaks, I think we were on the hook for about 6 or 7 hours. But it was a wonderful time. Sadly, it ended in God's providence. There was an act of God in which Bruce was caught in a thunderstorm, which was on the national news the next day. So this is no joke. But he lost his internet connection. Again, act of God. We can't do anything about that. Thankfully, he was able to reconnect maybe 20, 30 minutes later. But sadly, the platform we were using at the time would not allow us to admit him through the mobile app. I don't know why. So people could watch the event on the mobile app for the platform we were using, but you couldn't contribute. So we couldn't patch him back in. So seeing that, we certainly want to continue the conversation. And really what was for me going to be one of the high points of the whole event was you two speaking with each other in the last session. We want to make sure that we continue that. So we certainly wanted to invite Bruce back as soon as possible to talk about his book, The Roots of Reformed Moral Theology. And we're going to do that for about half an hour specifically. But then in the latter half of this episode, we're certainly going to have a fun, charitable, but spirited conversation on some matters regarding the law. Maybe starting on the law as it's treated and understood in the Gospels. That's what we were talking about in the symposium session, but we'll see where it goes and we'll take it. Looking at broader contours of continuity and discontinuity regarding the revelation of God's law throughout history. So with all that being said, I do want to let everyone know you can get a copy of Bruce's book, The Roots of Reformed Moral Theology. It's published by Reformation Heritage Books relatively recently. That was in 22. He's also written China's Reforming Churches with RHB in 2014. Head on over to RHB's website for that. We'll have links in the episode description to make sure you get a copy. And this is a wonderful book, and I've been really enjoying working through it myself. I looked at it in great detail on the chapter on the Gospels, but now being able to talk about the whole book, it's an exciting time. Bruce, I want to start just with an intro question, one of these perfunctory questions that interviewers have to ask. But I'm wondering, given the title, if you might introduce us to the subject of Reformed moral theology. If people have studied Catholic theology, for example, they'll know that's one of the key elements of the theological encyclopedia. But for some people who may be new to Reformed theology or maybe haven't had a very broad range, could you explain what moral theology is in general, but specifically how you treat Reformed moral theology as a discipline, as a subject, and how that might relate to the other fields of inquiry in the theological encyclopedia?
Yeah, thanks. I think it's a great place to start. I prefer the term moral theology over ethics, and I talk about that a bit in the book. And there's multiple reasons for that, but one of the primary reasons is if you just today pick open any kind of standard reference book and look up ethics, it's very likely going to define it as a branch of philosophy. Hmm. And that's often how it's conceived. And sometimes that's how it's approached even by evangelical scholars and so forth. And I wanted to make clear that I see myself here as involved in a branch of theology and not philosophy. And I do believe that moral theology is a somewhat neglected branch that of theology. It belongs to the theological encyclopedia. And so I'm trying to put a bit of a spotlight on that and kind of make a claim that says, hey, we need moral theology to go alongside biblical theology, systematic theology, and so on. And so that's kind of what's lying behind that. I'm trying to make an argument. Now, the argument's a little bit larger than that I try to develop in the book, which is that moral theology is a kind of scholarly discipline, and I would distinguish scholarly discipline from academic discipline somewhat. Obviously, academic disciplines are scholarly disciplines, but I would say that if you're going to define academic discipline as in relationship to a university department or something like that, I want to take scholarly a little bit broader to say it's a textual-based, rigorous study of a subject matter. On that definition, on that view of what a scholarly discipline would be, I try to make an argument that moral theology has been a scholarly discipline that really dates back to the foot of Sinai and the giving of the law in a written summary form, and then the institution of offices in the Mosaic Covenant, who are officers who are charged with the study and application of that law to their current cultural context. And so I think that's what moral theologians are doing. And I think that we have good biblical evidence to say that's been going on for quite a long time down through the generations.
Camden, you had invited me to throw in questions here. Do you mind if I...
I was just going to ask you, Dave. I was going to ask you literally a question because I was wondering about, in the Westminster Seminary tradition, both East and West California, we often talk about Christian ethics. I was curious about your thoughts on that, but take it wherever you want to go.
Yeah. Well, I was going to follow up on that. And when I saw the title of Bruce's book, whenever that was last year, I was delighted that he used the term moral theology because I also prefer that terminology, and I have a forthcoming Reformed Moral Theology. That would be the title of my book. But I almost always have to explain what it is to people, and I end up saying something like, well, you might think of it as an ethics, but I actually would prefer not to use that term. And I was going to ask Bruce what he thinks about this. I mean, one of my concerns, I mean, I warmly agree with what you were just saying, and I share your sentiments about the reasons why you prefer moral theology to ethics. But one thing that also has sometimes struck me is that people think of ethics very much in terms of kind of problem solving. You got a big crisis issue, and you need to solve a crisis issue. And of course, that's one thing that moral theology will do. But in my view, moral theology is so much broader. It's a theology of the whole Christian life in a way that includes things like virtue and spirituality. And that I don't think ethics captures that as well as moral theology. So I'm curious whether you would look at it that way as well.
Yeah, I think similarly. And so moral theology, another reason why I like the term moral theology is not only because it locates it as a branch of theology, but as Bavinck says, what makes theology theological is it has constant reference to God. And I really want to press in to that and say, you know, when we're doing moral theology, we're really dealing with the knowledge of God. We're dealing with the knowledge of God and his will towards how humans ought to conduct themselves, towards the kind of people we're called to be, we were created to be, that we're being redeemed to be. And so we're really dealing here with the knowledge of God. And I want to use that as the framing device for thinking about what we're doing in moral theology. And for that very reason, it brings in a lot more than sort of often is brought in under sort of ethics courses, you know, would you kill the fat man kind of thing.
Mm. Now, the title not only has the term moral theology in it, but also roots. And one of the interesting analogies, illustrations, the metaphors you use right at the beginning is to speak of a tree. And you speak of a very particular tree, the Y oak on Maryland's eastern shore. Can you let us know what that is and you know, paint that picture for us? Because I think it was a powerful metaphor, powerful image to begin the book with.
Yeah, it was a white oak tree on that was just down the road from where I grew up. I think it had some kind of official designation as like the Maryland State Tree or something like this. And it was hundreds of years old, centuries old, with a huge canopy, spreading limbs. It was a beautiful specimen and one of the oldest specimens of its kind known in America. And it stood for a very long time, rooted in a nice sort of rich soil and with these deep roots. And so I just always knew about that tree and thought of it as a majestic specimen. And when now that I'm, you know, much later in life and have moved away from the area and so forth, and when I think about moral theology, especially Reformed moral theology, I think there's this really stately, majestic tree that exists that is somewhat overlooked and unknown. And I wanted to explore the subterranean parts, the root structure. And that's the stuff that people don't usually see or think about. And for me, I was thinking about that historically. What's the background? Reformed moral theology doesn't drop in out of the sky from nowhere. It's like that tree. It started a long time ago when it was just a seedling, right? But it has grown up and it's rooted in this tradition and it draws the nutrients out of that tradition. Of course, scripture primarily, but also as understood and as scripture has been interpreted and explained down through the generations. And Reformed moral theology very much works in that context, is aware of its context, has picked up debates and questions from that context, takes positions within the framework of the debates that they inherited and so forth. And I wanted to kind of develop that and lay that out.
Yeah, I love that. Tell us a bit about or unpack some of those key historical and theological influences on Reformed moral theology. It's important that we always recognize that we do find ourselves within a tradition, but also that our current context might not be identical to the original context in which some of these lessons were first learned. But it's important that we recognize our situatedness. But what are some of the key influences or features or events that you find most significant for teaching a Reformed moral theology?
Yeah, well, this the book actually, maybe I shouldn't admit this, but it was kind of an accidental book. So I started on a project that was going to be more of a system of Reformed moral theology for a textbook to be used in my classroom. And when I got to the division, which was supposed to be like a little tiny unit on historical background to making the case for moral theology, it just kind of kept growing to the point that I realized, you know, I think I actually have a book here. And Reformation Heritage was happy enough to say, yeah, I think you do too.
And
so,
that's great.
And so that's how it developed. And so when it sort of grew, I was thinking about, I just want to make a context here so that people realize that things like the division between the moral, the ceremonial, and the judicial aspects of the moral law isn't original to Reformed theology. It might be codified in our confessional standards, but that's not new. We think, I mean, that's just where people's minds go when they think of a Reformed approach to the law, and rightly so, but that's not new. That has ancient roots in the tradition. And I try to argue in the book, I think, right back to the scriptures. And so that would be an example. The I mean, I kind of can light over sort of the natural law background to Reform moral theology, because people like Dave and Stephen Graybill and others, I think, have done fantastic work. So I can just sort of note that and move on. But that would be another one, to recognize that there's this long, natural, and rich and varied natural law tradition down through the tradition that the majority of the Reformed, all the Reformed I'm aware of actually in the Reformed Orthodox era, are taking up and working with as they go forward. So that would be another one. I just wanted to take some of these, I think I refer to them someplace as the bulkier roots, and just kind of trace them back a little bit and just observe, where's this coming from? Where do we get these distinctions? How does this develop over time? And so these are the kinds of things, just the big outlines, sure, the big contours that you think of.
No, that's
rules helpful. For how to interpret the Decalogue. Why is the Decalogue often prioritized, not to the exclusion, not as a law-based approach to the exclusion of virtue, by the way, which is a view that's come in. But it is true that the Decalogue is a major structuring device for thinking about as a framework for dealing with and developing and harmonizing the virtues and developing an account of the moral order in Reformed theology. Where does that come from? Well, that's not new to the Reformed either. So I just wanted to make that case. It's in my mind, it started as maybe a three chapter case and it ended up as a book.
It's nice when that happens. That's good. And we're glad to be able to reap the fruit of that and benefit from it. That speaks a little bit about the continuity of the Reformed moral theological tradition and the importance of finding ourselves in the Reformed tradition in that. But what are some areas in which Reformed moral theology is distinctly Reformed, in which it's developed? I'm curious to see the other side maybe of that question and how it's distinguished, for example, from perhaps a Roman Catholic moral theology or some other forms.
Yeah, the first thing that I would point out is that Reformed moral theology, just like all of Reformed theology, is developed within an increasingly rich and robust covenant theology. And so that context of covenant theology, which contextualizes our Christology and so forth, soteriology and the like, also is the structure. It provides the framework for our moral theology as well. And that's a flavor that you get in the Reformed tradition that is quite distinct to the Reformed tradition. Doesn't mean that there weren't people thinking, I mean, the question about Old Testament, New Testament, as it relates to moral theology is, in one form or another, it's in Lombard, It's in Thomas. It's not new to the Reformed exactly, but it's developed so much more richly in the Reformed and by the Reformed. And so that would be one point. One of the things that I point out in the book is that it's very important that Protestants understand that moral theology in the Roman Catholic tradition plays a very different role. And that's obvious when you think about their so-called sacrament of penance and how their ministers need to be trained in sort of matching prescriptions of penance to the kinds of sins that people are coming and confessing. And so that's one reason why the Roman Catholic Church is never able to sort of neglect their moral theology, to get away from it. I mean, they can, don't get me wrong, but why they have tended not to do so as badly as Protestants have at times, I think. But it's also tied into their sort of sacerdotal or soteriological views in a way that's completely distinct and different from what you would find in Reform circles, of course, with our rejection of penance and serious criticisms of penance. So that would be another example of how there's significant difference there. And one that needs to be kept in mind is a lot of Protestants look to the Roman Catholic moral theology tradition with some degree of admiration, it seems, because, hey, they've got this stuff. They've spent some time thinking about it. They're very thoughtful on it. They're in their own way consistent with their own presuppositions and so forth, very robust and clear. And so that's been something that in our state of cultural moral chaos, I think a lot of Protestants have admired in Roman Catholic moral teaching. I think we need to just rediscover our own distinctive Protestant and Reformed version of that, which is there and every bit as robust and even clearer.
Dave, you have any questions on this point before we might turn to portions of Scripture more specifically?
I was just thinking as Bruce was making these last comments, how, of course, Thomas Aquinas's Summa Theologiae is in some ways sort of a giant moral theology with some other things attached to it. But, you know, he gets to his doctrine of justification in the midst of what is truly a moral theology, in the midst of his talking about law. And you think about how, in a sense, justification emerges, it happens in the midst of following one's moral theology. Whereas I think, you know, for the Reformed, justification has a much more foundational element, is that we believe that the whole Christian life, at least the true moral life, is going to be built on the foundation of a justification that happens outside of our own works, our own virtues. And I think that's related to your comments about penance and all that, but it's, it seems to me that's a good illustration of what Bruce was talking about, of just the where moral theology fits within our broader theological system. I think it is really different from the Roman Catholic system, which I think is more following the Thomistic model there.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I ended up devoting more space to, I think, in the book than I had originally anticipated. I hadn't really thought about it a whole lot one way or the other, and that was Theological Encyclopedia and the Loci, the structure of the Loci, and where does moral theology fit in with the other topics? That's an evolving thing over the history of the church for everybody, but it is very revealing of how soteriology and moral theology are blurred and, I would argue, confused in much of the earlier tradition, which receives a very clear distinction and separation in light of justification within the Reformed tradition.
That's useful. One of the things, of course, people are going to want to talk about whenever we talk about moral theology, especially within our Reformed circles, is to get back to Moses and talk about how Moses relates. That's an important question as we are dealing with covenant theology and covenant theology being so central to distinctly Reformed moral theology, as you mentioned. How have the Reformed typically treated the giving of the law and looking at perhaps the covenant historical or redemptive historical context in which that happened? Why is this such a point of discussion all the time? And I guess I'm curious what your thoughts are on the varieties that we have within the Reformed tradition on some of these matters.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because there is variety, and there's sort of a couple levels of the discussion, right? So there are those things that are distinctive to the Reformed tradition quite broadly, which are codified to a large extent in things like the Westminster Standards, Three Forms of Unity. And then within those bounds, there is a lot of diversity and ongoing discussion. And part of that's just, you know, how covenant theology is unfolding and being developed over the period of time, what the implications of that are for understanding continuities, discontinuities across the various administrations of the covenant of grace, and so on. And so because there's lots of room for differences and lots of different things that are said in Scripture that have to be fit together and teased out, I think it's too much to say you don't find anybody who is perfectly in agreement with one other person within the tradition, but there's a lot of room for nuance and subtlety and differences at that level. Sometimes they erupted into pretty significant debates, like between the Voetians and the Coxeans in Dutch tradition.
Yeah.
But at other times, they've been sort of, you know, much less significant in the implications for the church and the life of the church, maybe, than that. But yeah, there's a lot of variety there. So, you know, I mean, I can't avoid it in my book, in my other writings, in my thinking, my speaking on these topics, my teachings. I can't avoid taking positions on some of these things that are intra-confessional, but I try to really focus and put my weight on trying to demonstrate where does Westminster stand? How did Westminster get to this place? Where do these rules for interpreting the law come from? Why is the Decalogue so prominent in their treatment of moral theology? It's completely structured in the larger and shorter catechisms around the law. Why do we have a whole chapter on the law to tease this out, and so on? So those are the things that I try to focus on.
Yeah, it's useful. Certainly we'll pick up on some of those themes diving deeper into Moses specifically, but I do want to mention, just to get back to some of the historical development, chapters 6 through 9 of Bruce's book go into detail on different eras within the church. So we're working through here the biblical history, but then Bruce will eventually get to. I just want to make sure I mention this because I feel like, well, once we shift gears, we might not come back to this point. Maybe. But there are chapters on early church era, late antiquity and early medieval eras, then the high medieval era and the late medieval era. So these are things you definitely don't want to miss. There's great detail in there, helpful contributions. So that's an important section. But to come back to the Old Testament, or to speak about Moses and the law and its eventual place within a Reformed moral theology, how does some of those aspects of the Old Testament address some of the perennial ethical questions that might even challenge us today? Obviously, God is revealing to us his law, and specifically even a moral law that is continually binding. We might have a debate about that in terms of how. But this isn't just something that happened several thousand years ago as a historical curiosity. Mm-hmm. There's something greatly significant in terms of what God is doing at Sinai that has certainly a bearing upon us in terms of God's revelation and revealing of his own character. So, how might we look at this, and why ought we to look at this with perhaps, I don't know what I'm, you know, how I might put it, but greater care and attention to detail.
Well, I'll say some things, and let me see if I'm getting at anything like what you're trying to ask about here.
Sure. Thank you for that gracious response.
You know, I do think that it's the Ten Commandments are given in Exodus 20 in terms of their canonical location. Exodus 20, repeated again in Deuteronomy 5. There's a tremendous amount of emphasis. The only thing that we have that's written explicitly by the finger of God, that's given with such a sort of, vivid theophany, right? That's taking place at Sinai with all of the sort of intention focusing effect or power that all of that context has. He's just brought these people up out of Egypt with his mighty hand in judgments against the Egyptian pantheon. He brings them out here so that they might know him, worship him, that he might enter into this covenant administration with them. And then what's the centerpiece of what Moses has summoned up onto the mountain and given and brought back down? You know, it's these 10 words, right? It's this, these, and there's even some debate about what exactly are the 10 words. We know there's 10 because the Bible says there's 10, but it doesn't tell us what are the 10 exactly. Mm-hmm. And so how do you number that? And different traditions have different ways of working that out. But however you look at it, here's how I look at what's going on there, is that every covenant can be between God and humans can be summarized as, I will be your God and you shall be my people. And God has just declared what it means for him to be our God. I'm the one who redeemed you, who have brought you. Grace has already been demonstrated or proven. You are under grace. You're recipients of grace. I've brought you out here with a mighty hand, right? And so I've delivered you and brought you to this place. Now, what does it mean to be his people? And I really like to, I don't think I draw this out in the book maybe as fully as I want to, because I'm planning on writing another one here. And I hope to develop this maybe more in that one. But one of the things that I want us to see in this is that, you know, God is giving himself to us in this covenant, in the covenant of grace. He gives himself to us. Well, how does he give himself to us? What are the lines along which he's given himself to us? Well, that's enumerated in his promises, in the covenant promises. And then we are to give ourselves to God. It's a mutual belonging to each other. It's a union between us and so forth. And what does it mean for us to give ourselves to God? I think law gets looked at very simplistically and sort of almost atheologically sometimes as something flat and just stating obligations. But in the context of the Mosaic administration of the covenant of grace, and I would argue in each administration of the covenant of grace, it's describing for us how we give ourselves to God. This is how we give ourselves. He is, so how do you do that? Well, you worship him and him only, right? And you worship him in just the way that he's giving himself to you and says that he will accept your worship, that he will meet with you. So second commandment. And you respect and honor him. Third commandment. You rest yourself wholly in the sufficiency of his provision for you. Fourth commandment. You're the kind of person who honors authority wherever you find it. This is how you know your God, walk with your God, enjoy your God, live in communion with your God, define your fruition, find your happiness, your enjoyment in God in this life. And so we are giving ourselves to him. If you love me, keep my commandments, right? Teach them to observe everything I've commanded you, and walk before me and be blameless, he tells Abraham, right? And so this is it's the mutual belonging, and that's what I really want people to see. So I would argue that the summary that what he's giving, you know, this isn't just me, but what he's giving at Sinai is a summary, very short, concise summary, but a sufficient summary of the moral order, which has been in place from creation. The kind of thing that is universal, all people in all places are being held to these standards. We need to do a little bit maybe of work with Sabbath on that point, but in general, these are the kinds of things that even before you get to Sinai, God is holding people accountable for doing or not doing. And then these are the kinds of things that the prophets hold the nations accountable for, not the ceremonial, not the judicial aspects of the law, but the moral aspects that are summarized at Sinai. And these are the kinds of things that clearly Christ expects his people to be fulfilling and walking in as his disciples, and that he himself teaches. And so I think that what's given here really belongs to the original terms of the covenant of works, but is being recontextualized now in the context of grace. So this is not how are we to be justified before God, but this is how people in covenant with him under grace commune with him, enjoy him, know him, walk with him, honor him, glorify him, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is bringing us closer to some of the touching points from the fourth session in their symposium. We won't have obviously enough space or time to rehash everything there, but I want to give both of our participants today opportunity to interact with one another. So we might be jumping into a conversation in mid-stride, so to speak. But it's quite interesting, it was for me, to hear both of you commenting on some of Jesus' words, in particularly the Sermon on the Mount, on how he viewed the law and how he views his relation to it, and how his words pertain. But there's been different interpretations of that, different understandings of what Jesus meant and how his words in the Sermon on the Mount are meant to contextualize or characterize the law of Moses specifically. Bruce, would you mind picking up maybe on some of those themes, and then I'll just let Dave respond, and you guys can go at it.
So, you know, as Dave said in the symposium at one point, you know, when it comes to the content of our judgments about moral matters, I think we're going to be in agreement, 99% or more of the time, something close to this anyway. And so I don't think there's going to be a big difference between us in that area. But I do think that we have, I would lean more in emphasizing and stressing continuities. I don't want to characterize Dave's view, but that's how I would see myself over against what I've been hearing Dave say and reading Dave say. And so I would see Jesus, and what that looks like for Sermon on the Mount and the Gospel of Matthew, is I would see Jesus actually articulating what the moral law has always meant as given at Sinai, correcting certain common misunderstandings or misconceptions, the kinds of things that we see actually people suggesting later in the Gospel of Matthew. So, the rich young man who says, oh, I've been doing this from my youth, right? Can only say that if he has a very narrow kind of understanding of the scope and application of each one of those commandments, not the one that Jesus is offering in the Sermon on the Mount. And so what I think is going on is that Jesus is aware of our common sinful fallen tendency to manipulate the moral law as summarized at Sinai down into something that we can cope with. We can try to manage. We can try to say to ourselves, well, I might not be perfect, but I think I can skate by, or I'm okay on this. And he's not letting us get away with that. And so what I would see him doing is drawing out the original sort of understanding and intent of the Ten Commandments, as summarized through a few examples. He's not treating the whole of the Decalogue, but his examples are drawn largely from the Decalogue, and therefore giving us the true sense, and by way of doing so, showing us how to interpret and apply the moral precepts expounded in the Decalogue, but all through Scripture, to our own context and to our own lives at this period of time. And what it is, this is an exposition of what perfect love for God and neighbor is.
Yeah, thanks, Bruce. And it's been good to hear you talk about your book, and I enjoyed reading it as I was working through it. And I would echo what Bruce was saying. I think our discussion is not, there probably is very little substantive moral difference in how we would think about the Christian life and our responsibilities here and now. But I do have a different way of understanding if we're focused, especially on the Sermon on the Mount and Jesus' exposition, especially in the second half of Matthew 5, I do take a different approach to that. And I think that it is important to work through these things, because this is, and we would all agree, this is an important moral text for understanding our responsibilities. And so we want to handle it as best we can. And Bruce's interpretation is certainly a very common one in the Reformed tradition. I would certainly admit that. But I would say that my own convictions as I have worked on this text is to see, maybe to put it in Bruce's terms, that to think that Jesus is less concerned about showing the continuity of the moral law through history as in showing the climactic character of his coming, and that he is really, he is bringing the kingdom of heaven. He is bringing a new covenant. He is, you might say, he's bringing redemptive history to this consummation. And to put it also in Bruce's terms from earlier, I would say it's I am thinking about this very covenantally, that Jesus is very concerned to show we are no longer going to be under the old covenant. We're no longer under the Mosaic covenant. There is a new covenant, and now this is how God's people are to live. And so the way I would take Jesus' main point in the second part of Matthew 5, when he six times says, "You've heard it said, but I say to you," is that Jesus is not really trying to correct misinterpretations of the Mosaic law, but what he's trying to say is, this is what you have heard under the Mosaic law. But now I am saying to you this, and your moral life is not going to look identical under the new covenant to the way it looked under Moses. Under Moses, it was good. It was consistent with the universal moral law. It was good for that era of redemptive history, but something new has come with the Lord Jesus Christ, and that Jesus is trying to highlight that. Not that there aren't moral continuities. Of course, there are moral continuities, but I think to my mind, it becomes especially clear in the latter two of these six so-called antitheses. You've heard it said, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. And that's Mosaic law. That's not misinterpretation. That is actually something that the Israelites under Moses were supposed to do. And Jesus says, no, the way I'm understanding it, this is not to characterize you as the new covenant people of God. We are not a new covenant community that is about enforcing retributive justice. So I think a main concern Jesus has here is to alert the people, look, the new covenant community, unlike the old covenant community, is not going to be a geopolitical entity that is concerned about enforcing by the physical sword the demands of justice. Something new has gone on. We are a new covenant people in which church the way we handle conflicts and sins against each other is marked by what Jesus will talk about in Matthew 18 about seeking reconciliation and forgiveness. And in the final of those six antitheses, where Jesus says, "You've heard it said, love your neighbor, hate your enemies. But I say to you, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you." And this is probably the most controversial or the most debatable thing about my interpretation about these verses. But I think, again, Jesus is actually talking about what was the case under the Mosaic law, and that there were enemies that they were to hate. There were enemies that Israel had to fight against and destroy. They were called to exercise holy war in their land. And Jesus is alerting his people, I believe. He's alerting us as a new covenant people. We're not living in a holy promised land any longer. We are not to try to expunge our non-Christian neighbors from this earth. And here again, I think there's anticipation of the Great Commission, which is going to come at the very end of Matthew's gospel. We are to evangelize all nations. We're to baptize them and make them disciples. We're not to put them to the sword. And so I think I would certainly affirm a lot of things that Bruce is saying, and I believe that there is a moral law that summarizes summarizes the obligations of all people at all times in all eras of redemptive history. But I do think Jesus' emphasis here in the Sermon on the Mount is not so much to correct or give a better interpretation of how things worked under Moses, but really to highlight the eschatological climax of Jesus' coming, as he encapsulates with his idea, he has come to fulfill the law, Matthew 5:17, which is a very common, rich idea through the Gospel of Matthew, the fulfillment of all the Old Testament things. So I hope that wasn't too long of an answer. That's just to kind of catch listeners up. I think that, as I would understand it, that would be kind of highlight the main differences that I would have with the way Bruce would read that. And I'd be happy. There's at least one other thing I think would be kind of fun to talk about, but I can just kind of leave that there. I'd be happy to.
Could I respond to?
Yeah, please pick it back up, Bruce. Yeah, I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, so I actually, I don't know, I don't think this will surprise Dave too much, but I would actually agree that there is clearly an emphasis, not only in the Sermon on the Mount, but all the way through the New Testament. The focus is on applying to the degree that the New Testament gets into moral precepts. And there is a lot of this in the New Testament, but to the degree that it does, it's focused on the church and the people in the church and what this looks like and how this applies into disciples of Christ. And so I do think that that's clearly an emphasis all through the New Testament. And it's actually, you know, if we're interested in constructing an account of our moral obligations as divine image bearers that apply to all people in all places and all times, that becomes an actual sort of hermeneutic challenge in using scripture, either in the Old or the New Testament, because the primary focus is on the covenant community under that administration at that age. And so we need to always be thinking about that and taking that into account. So there, you know, I can sort of say yes to some things that I'm hearing. Here's where my concern starts to go up a little bit in terms of I wouldn't say it this way and be comfortable doing so myself. And that's not that there's a significant difference between Mosaic and new administrations of the covenant of grace, but rather the kinds of things that Dave was pointing out there that Jesus takes up in the Sermon on the Mount, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, and you know, hate your enemy and so forth. I would say that these things are things that belong to the judicial within the Mosaic, and that the better way maybe to think about continuity, discontinuity as it relates to this is that the judicial is not coming over. And I think that is perfectly clear in the New Testament. But the way that you stated and characterize it, Dave, constantly gives me a little bit of concern, because it sounds like you're suggesting that there's a change in the moral and not just sort of a dropping off of the judicial that related to the Israel's estate, and but rather an actual change in the moral between the Mosaic and the new. And I'm not comfortable going there. I want to say there's perfect continuity and agreement in the moral between the Mosaic and the new, but that both administrations have a kind of order for the church. Theirs was a theocratic kind of order. Ours is not. It's Presbyterianism. And theirs is, you know, they had a ceremonial order for worship, and ours is much more simple with a greater sense of the fulfillment that we have in Christ and so on. And so, yeah, I do think that there's significant differences, but I'm pretty content with being able to account for those differences in terms of judicial ceremonial. And I really want to guard a suggestion that there's actual change in the moral, because I think we begin to lose grip then on the idea that there is a moral order that's universal across all ages, for all times, for all people in all places. It's culturally transcendent.
Yeah. I mean, if I could put you at ease a bit, I wouldn't say that there is a change of the moral law. I believe that there is a moral law that binds all people, at all times. And so I guess you might say, okay, for those last two antitheses, you might say human life is one of the things that is at issue there. I would say that there's no change from old to new about the value of human life or the fact that we should not take human life unjustly. There again, I think there is some change of what constitutes a just taking of human life. I'm sure you would agree with that. There are certain ways that it would be unjust for us to take a human life that was not unjust for an Israelite to take a life. And so I do think that we can go back, and if we say, okay, well, you know, how do we think theologically? How do we put theological categories to explain why Moses could command this? And now the New Testament can come and say, no, you ought not to do that any longer. You ought not to wage holy war any longer. I mean, how can we do that? And I think to say, oh, okay, we can make a distinction between moral law and judicial law, I think that's helpful. And I think, as you know, I mean, I think that the distinction of moral, ceremonial, judicial aspects of the law is a good theological category that certainly has a lot of payoff for us. And I think it's, you know, maybe to go back to Matthew 5, then in a way, it's getting at, you know, what exactly is Jesus trying to do? Is Jesus himself thinking about how do I apply the moral law? Or is he thinking about the fact we are not under Moses any longer because the Messiah is here. And now that I have come, nothing can be the same. And I would see it as in this movement of redemptive history and the dawning of this semi-eschatological age. You should let Reform Forum listeners know what that is. I would take
it. Yeah, we talk about that kind of stuff a little bit.
So, you know, that I would say that this is what I think Jesus is doing. And I think this is true. This comes out in a lot through the rest of the Gospel of Matthew. I think elsewhere in the New Testament too, but just in thinking of in those specific terms, that you know, I would look at the Pharisees from a slightly different angle from the way that some other Reformed people do, only a slightly different angle. In that, I think that the Pharisees' prime problem was not that they were hypocrites, although they were hypocrites. The prime problem was not that they focused unduly on, you know, small matters rather than big matters, although they did that as well. But their prime problem was that they didn't recognize that Jesus was the Messiah. And that, in a sense, it wasn't so much that they were bad exegetes per se. I think they understood a lot of things about, they knew a lot about the law but they didn't recognize the Messiah. And I think that skewed their whole perspective. And I think a major thing that Jesus is doing in Matthew, and I think the other Gospels as well, is exposing the problems of the life they lived and the way they looked at the law in a sort of this Jesus-less way. They didn't recognize this his coming. And so I think that ties in with the way I'm looking at Matthew 5. It's not so much trying to correct misinterpretations of the law itself, so much as trying to show how important, how climactic his coming really is.
That's helpful to me to hear you say it. And some of the phrases that you used then are a little bit helpful to me. But I would view it like this a little bit, that it seems like in 5:17 and following, Jesus is actually putting himself, in other words, what is the redemptive historical significance of Jesus coming in fulfillment of all these things? It seems to me his emphasis really is on grounding that in the Old Testament, in the Law and the Prophets. And he's coming announcing that I haven't come to abolish any of that. I've not come to eliminate any of that. I've come as the fulfillment of that. And I know we probably have slightly different ways of nuancing what he means by fulfillment there, but it's a fulfillment over against abolish. And then he specifies exactly what he's talking about. And he says, you know, these commandments, anyone who teaches somebody, you know, to in a way that trivializes these commandments is going to be least in the kingdom. And then I think that contextualizes it. And so what he's doing is he's grounding the way to interpret his redemptive historical significance, you know, of him as the Word made flesh come to save his people from their sins, is actually to ground it in that context. And thus he's stressing continuity here, actually, which is the very thing that sets the framework for understanding how radically different this is going to be now. And that without that continuity being asserted in, I actually think he is doing that so that the full significance of what's happening here is being brought to the fore. And then, you know, when we think about, he says, you know, the Law and the Prophets there in Matthew 5:17, you come back to that later in Matthew and he says, you know, that the Law and the Prophets hang on actually these two moral principles, which is really one moral principle with sort of two objects, right? A perfect love for God and for neighbor as self. And that he seems to summarize the whole. Now maybe summarize the whole is not the right way to put it. Hang on, I think, is a very interesting and fascinating way to characterize it. It depends at some level on the meaning and significance. You don't have the framework for making sense of how the law and the gospels actually point, or the law and the prophets point us to Christ. If you don't understand how they're speaking to us of the more obligation for perfect love for God and neighbor, and then that's expounded for us in summary form in the Decalogue, but then more fully. And then he comes saying, yeah, I'm going to fulfill that perfectly. And that's going to be, you know, world shattering, right? For sinners who are wanting to be reconciled to God or need to be reconciled to God.
You know, as I was saying, I think that there is this, that there's this natural moral order that, that does, we all live within it. It does bind all of us. And yet, as I've been, you know, trying to think really hard about, especially how God's law comes to us as a new covenant people, and that's a question that I keep putting to myself. How does God's law come to us as a new covenant people? And one of the things that I have come to think and to try to talk about is that there is a certain sense in which some of the, I might say even the fundamental things of this natural moral order become a bit relativized under the new covenant. And here's what I mean. Not that, to use, say, the sixth and seventh commandments, not that don't kill or don't commit adultery, that hasn't changed. But we see with regard to the sixth commandment that under the New Testament, you know, that, I mean, there's not really much concern about the new covenant people killing each other. I mean, it just, you don't get the sense that the apostles are really concerned that there's going to be murders committed within the new covenant community, and we need to know how to deal with that.
It was getting pretty wild, though.
Yeah.
Seventh commandment issues.
The way you do under the old covenant, the Mosaic law does spend a lot of time talking about murder and manslaughter and how you deal with it. But you do find in the New Testament, there is a real emphasis on the fact that you are putting your, if you come to Christ, you are putting your very life on the line for Christ. You are volunteering to die. You're volunteering to be a martyr. And, you know, as 1 Timothy 6 puts it, you know, what we seek is that which is truly life. And he's talking about resurrection life, new creation life. It seems to me that is it a change in the moral law? I don't think it's a change in the moral law. It's not the way I would want to put it, but because we have been brought into this semi-eschatological age, we've been given this citizenship in heaven where the resurrected Christ now reigns, that we now look at our earthly lives with a kind of a, we regard it as of less value than you would get the sense of just reading the Mosaic law. Something has changed. And I think something is true with regard to the seventh commandment as well. I think with other commandments, well, just to focus on these two for brevity, but it's not that family isn't important under the new covenant, but there is a kind of a relativization of the importance of family that I don't think you quite get it in the same way under the Mosaic law. Just remaining unmarried is now, it is good. It's a good option for Christians. It's a better option for some Christians. You would never get that. You would never get a sense of that by reading the Old Testament law that remaining, right. That living an unmarried life is a legitimate good option. It just is as if that life doesn't even exist. And, you know, there is a real emphasis on, you know, you have to be willing to leave your father and mother and your brothers and sisters, your children for the sake of Christ. And we know how important this is. I mean, we all know people who have left our churches because they valued family more than they valued Christ. They're in a way that I think you don't see it. It's not as if you had to choose under the old covenant that you would choose family over God, but it doesn't have the place or the emphasis under the new as under the old. And I think it's because of this, because we're living in the last days. The new creation has dawned in a way that it had not dawned under the old. So those are some thoughts that I have, and I'm genuinely curious how that hits you.
Yeah. Well, first off, let me just kind of jump on board there. I mean, Paul, when he's talking about when he's commending the sort of celibate life for the sake of the kingdom, says specifically, you know, the time is short, right? Right. And places that argument in the context of sort of the eschatological moment that we live in, and that we're in the last days. And so, yeah, I do think there's something to it. I think the seventh commandment, so this might be not the most helpful thing to say, but I'll say it like this. I do ponder the seventh commandment. I do believe that the moral principle that is being articulated in the seventh commandment is universal and eternal as it relates to human conduct. But what does that look like? What is the principle there that right now is focused on marriage? What does that look like when we're no longer married and given in marriage? I still think that there's something in the seventh commandment that is applicable to the new heavens and the new earth, and the kind, and is descriptive of the kind of people we're going to be perfectly. And yet the synecdoche of marriage, or adultery, I guess, as it's given in the seventh commandment, which I take to be primarily in reference to marriage and a protection of marriage, is going to change. And I do think that there's something to be said about that the already not yet phase that we live in, the last days that we live in, you use the language relativize. I don't want to use that as it relates to the moral order itself, but I think the judgments about what is the most prudent way to live under that order in this age are going to look different than they did under the Mosaic. And so I would see it in the area of application. So that maybe what the seventh commandment was the most immediate application and obvious application perhaps under the Mosaic was get married, have children. And that now we would say, well wait a minute. It's consistent with the seventh commandment to pursue lifelong celibacy if you're gifted and called for that, for the sake of the kingdom. And because of the last days context in which we live, that is a commended way to go if that gift and if you are able to bear it, right? And so I do think there's something like that, but I would see that a little bit more at the level of what would wisdom look like in terms of counseling people on how to fulfill the moral law and to think about its application to our context rather than an actual change of substance or of the moral precept itself. So yeah, as far as the sixth commandment, this isn't really quite addressing what you were raising, but I would get it a little bit of it maybe like this. I think love would compel a civil magistrate to use the power of sword to defend the people who are under his rule from tyranny, from assault, from violence, and therefore can compel them to use the power of the sword even to kill, to wage war. I think in the Mosaic order, of course, we have a theocratic order for the church, so that this is very much something that belongs to the magistrates, the civil magistrates within the Mosaic covenant, which is no longer something that belongs to the new covenant at all. But I do think there's still a place where that applies to civil magistrates. Now, that's not because of a theocratic state or that we should be trying to recover a theocratic state. This isn't an argument for theonomy at all. But I do think that you can say that the principle of love would still compel the civil magistrate to use the power of the sword to kill at this time, and appropriately so. And so, but that's not the church, and that's not who we are, and that's not our business. And so that's not really quite on target with what you were saying about the sixth commandment, but it's a piece of the puzzle.
I don't feel like I need to say anything more, but I am glad to hear that you would concur that there is significance of the fact that we are living in the last days, and mm-hmm. yeah, and
that's of emphasis.
Yeah, that there is a sense in which we are learning now how to live as we will as a new creation people. When you know there won't be marriage, in heaven. And I do think that is important for why living an unmarried life now can be good and even a better thing for some, and that we need to learn to view our brothers and sisters in the church in some fundamental way as more our family than our family. Not that we don't want to have to give up our father and mother and brothers and sisters, our children for the sake of the kingdom, but we're willing to do so and maybe called to anticipate the life of the age to come in a way that is a very powerful testimony to the righteousness of the kingdom. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and it is interesting. I mean, I think it'd be worth further discussion. I don't think we can do it now, Camden, but it's the idea of a natural, you know, we've obviously been talking a lot about the moral law, and you made some mention about the natural law. I think we would agree that the moral law is a natural moral order. And I think it really is worth some careful thinking about, okay, when there's a new creation, the natural order is not going to be identical to what the natural order is the way we know it now. And while obviously the holiness of God is not going to change, that don't commit adultery is not, it just can't mean the same thing in the age to come as what it means now. And I think it may be worth some thought about that, is that if the natural order, the created order itself, is going to change, I don't think we can talk about a natural moral order that just sort of continues on uninterrupted in every respect into the age to come. But how exactly to explain that is, it's not immediately obvious the best way to try to unpack that.
Yeah, I've been a little bit apprehensive of going down that path a little bit, because I feel like I get into something I don't know what I'm talking about in terms of the age to come, right? Which is so sketchy.
Well, that's kind of how it is with the age to come, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so, but I do use this kind of formula in my teaching. I don't remember if I use this in the book anywhere, but because I'm committed to a natural law account of the moral order, I say that I believe that if you're committed to that in general, now there's a lot of nuance in terms of what that means and how it relates to the Decalogue and so forth, but in general, you're committed to the idea that there would not be a change in the moral order without an underlying change of the natural order. Now, does the eschaton, right, the end of this present age and the translation, it certainly seems like that passages like 1 Corinthians 15 are envisioning a pretty fundamental change. We're still going to be human in the full sense of what it means to be human. We're still going to be some kind of psychosomatic unity, I think, unit. And so we're still going to be embodied souls in the age to come. The bodily resurrection is fundamental here. But I'm at least open, and I think I lean towards the idea that there's going to be a kind of fundamental change of the natural order at some level that at least opens the possibility that the moral order is going to look somewhat different. It's certainly, I would say, at least this much, that the particular synecdoches that are selected in the Decalogue will not have the same residence in the age to come that they do in this present age. I'm still married. I believe the seventh commandment fully applies to me. Just want to go on the record for that one. but in all seriousness, as long as we still live in an already not yet, I think the Decalogue applies to us fully and governs us. And I think that's true of the fourth commandment, right? And I think the synecdoches changed from last day, first day, but nevertheless, it's changed. But the synecdoche is selected adultery. Some other example is going to need to be in place there. And I'm not sure that we are in a position to be able to say with it's kind of a settled finality exactly what that was going to look like. So that's kind of how I shake that out at the moment. But I'm quite open to being corrected and learning more as I think through that particular question.
Mm. Lots of great things. I've got lots of thoughts, but I'm going to keep them to myself for the moment, not give myself any trouble. But this is a tremendous conversation, really interesting. And I want to thank both of you for taking the time and being willing to do something like this. And both being charitable and kind and gracious to one another and to me. And I hope that is felt in reverse as well. I've enjoyed all of our exchanges, not just at the symposium and here, but even witnessing you brothers and T. David interacting on email. It's been exemplary. So thank you for that. And I hope our listeners appreciate this as well, and certainly want to encourage people to follow up. We look forward to David's book when it comes out in the future on the subject, although he has many other books on natural law and the covenants and divine moral order and many things there. Take a look at the links that I'll try to include in the episode description. And of course, I want to point people to Dr. Baugus's book, The Roots of Reformed Moral Theology, published by Reformation Heritage Books just in 2022. That book is available as well. I point you to RHB in particular to get a copy there. But this has been a great conversation. It's wonderful. I appreciate you brothers greatly. Thanks so much for taking the time to join me today.
Thank you. Thank you, Dave. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks, Bruce.
Amen. Well, we've look forward to maybe picking the conversation back up, having more symposia in the future, perhaps other podcast discussions on the topic. If you have any comments or questions, the best place to get a hold of us now is at community.reformedforum.org. That's a good place to keep the conversation going. And visit us online at reformedforum.org for information about all of our upcoming events, publications, courses, all sorts of interesting things. And of course, visit prts.edu and wscal.edu for information there as well. I do want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.